Welcome back. We're in the middle of chapter 12, The Significance of Sacrifice, in Essays on the Gita. He's touched upon the inner meaning and the wide connectivity that are commensurate when we offer our work by subduing desire, sense of egoism, and can simply give, can simply offer. You rise to the highest. You attain peace. One need not abandon nature and its activity to abandon grasping, claiming, self-arrogation. Those things can go. One can remain active, dynamic, and consecrated in life and in all action, thought, and feeling. This is our way. So we're going to take up this idea, continuing as Sri Aurobindo does, with the thought about what is Loka Sangraha. It's one of the great concepts that we have in the Gita. And maybe before we go very far into this, let's note that Loka means world, Sangraha means holding together, so it means literally holding the worlds together, holding the world together. Well, the idea in ancient India was that it's not simply the vast physical universe which is the world. There are worlds and worlds and worlds. So the idea suggests that in working in consecration with the divine, one helps to hold all the worlds together. And there are seven worlds. Bhu, the world of matter. Bhuvar, Svar. And in Svar, we begin to meet the higher gods. There dwell the great celestials like Indra, king of those heavens. And these three worlds, the material, the pranic, the vital, and the world of the mind, are all considered to be perishable. But when we go beyond, then we arrive at what is imperishable. And so the one who journeys through the cosmic course strides higher and higher, and the next, the fourth world, is Mahar, which means the great, the vast. And there, of course, we begin to meet the greatest sages. Bhrigu is there. We meet him in the Taittiriya Upanishad and frequently. Beyond that, Janar, which basically is the world of delight. And who lives there? Sanat Kumara, the eternal youth. Not alone. I don't mean to suggest that he's the only one there. And then we rise beyond that to the world of tapas. And there we come into the company of the Vairagins, those who are heroic in nature and have heroically distanced themselves from their passions. They can play in the world without being absorbed in the drama. But they're seated above. That is their natural home. And finally, the seventh world is Satya Loka, the world of truth, true being. So these seven worlds are all there. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, you're very familiar with that, of course, because father to son, son following father's guidance steps from the world of matter into the world of life, into the world of mind, into the world beyond the mind, and then still farther into the world of delight. And there, bliss, ananda, is the key to all creativity, the key to manifestation. But it counts that many worlds. Here, seven worlds is the backdrop to this Vedantic teaching. They are not enumerated here, but when we hold the world together, we're not just holding together human society. It's not just the people whose world gets held together by the action of the one who lives in communion, in knowledge, in heart, in act with the divine. That's what I want to mention here. And by the way, those of you who are familiar with the term uru, uru means free or open. And so there is, in the concept of the worlds, the uru loka, the world which is free, which is open in its space. In other words, nothing defines it. It is before the definition of the manifestation. So loka sangraha, we'll come to it, means the whole of the universe, everything, all the various strata that go into its composition. It is the aggregate of the worlds. And this is the way that the Vishnu Purana sees it also. Not simply the Bhagavad Gita, Vishnu Purana following, developing devotional approaches to the divine, taking the teaching of the Gita to the next steps. And of course, the Vishnu Purana, as you will remember from earlier discussions, was Sri Aurobindo's favorite of all the Puranas. So now, having said that as sort of a background, let's take up the balance of this chapter in Essays, The Significance of Sacrifice. That this is the sense of the passage is made clear in what follows by the affirmation of loka sangraha as the object of works, of prakriti as the sole doer of works, and the divine purusha as their equal upholder, to whom works have to be given up even in their doing. This inner giving up of works and yet physical doing of them is the culmination of sacrifice. And by the affirmation that the result of such active sacrifice with an equal and desireless mind is liberation from the bondage of works. The bondage results from ego, from attachment. We think we own this, and we suffer the consequences of egoistic action by grasping at the results. As long as we're identified with them and don't recognize that they belong there, then we are mastered by them. The upholder, Bharata. So all of this is essentially chapter 3, shlokas 20 through 25, except for this. This idea of the equal upholder, the divine purusha, that's chapter 13, shloka 22. We'll come to that subsequently. And then, he who is satisfied with whatever gain comes to him, and equal in failure and success, is not bound even when he acts. When a man liberated, free from attachment, acts for sacrifice, all his action is dissolved, leaves, that is to say, no result of bondage or after impression on his free, pure, perfect, and equal soul. This is 4:22 and 23. Braviliate, dissolved. To these passages, we shall have to return. They are followed by a perfectly explicit and detailed interpretation of the meaning of yajna in the language of the Gita, which leaves no doubt at all about the symbolic use of the words and the psychological character of the sacrifice enjoined by this teaching. And yajna we translate into English as meaning sacrifice, or offering, perhaps better rendered. In the ancient Vedic system, there was always a double sense, physical and psychological, outward and symbolic, the exterior form of the sacrifice and the inner meaning of all its circumstances. Of course, Sri Aurobindo, while he's going through the writing, the composition of the Arya, has significant chapters designated to the secret of the Veda and the hymns to the mystic fire. So some of what he's saying here has been adumbrated, you know, messaged already by him in other essays. But the secret symbolism of the ancient Vedic mystics, exact, curious, poetic, psychological, had been long forgotten by this time, and it is now replaced by another large, general, and philosophical in the spirit of Vedanta and a later yoga. So in other words, what the Veda meant is encapsulated and restated in these Vedantic teachings that we have here in the Gita. The fire of sacrifice, Agni, is no material flame, but Brahmagni, the fire of the Brahman, or it is the Brahmanward energy, inner Agni, priest of the sacrifice, into which the offering is poured. The fire is self-control, or it is a purified sense action, or it is the vital energy in that discipline of the control of the vital being through the control of the breath, which is common to Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga, or it is the fire of self-knowledge, the flame of the supreme sacrifice. So he's condensed here several shlokas from chapter 4, shlokas 24 through 31. The idea of the self-control, Atma Samyama Yogagno, that's 27. In fact, there are a number of terms that occur all in the 27th shloka. Indriya Karmani, Prana Karmani, the idea of this great liberating self-knowledge, jnana, but all of it pinned on Agni. Agni is the Lord of the fire, yes, and he dwells inside us. He is not simply on the physical hearth, but he is also cosmic. He is in the fire that carries the offering up. He is in the force, physical and inner, of lightning. He is in the force, physical and inner, of the sun and its rays and its radiance. So Agni, you can see, is the demonstration of a universal Godhead taking many forms as is appropriate to the manifestation, but essentially an aspect of Brahman, essential real being. So this is something that connects the ancient Vedic sacrifice to what he's talking about in this psychological interpretation of the meaning of what it means to give to the divine freely without claim, and how this is part of the universal approach to life and life's approach to the Supreme, because it is through yoga that the universe rejoins the Supreme, and who leads the yogic charge? Humans. That is their proper role, is to play this way of conjoining earthly aspiration back to the divine. The circuit becomes complete this way. You can see this is also something that is evident in the other forms of yoga, which have become so popular in recent centuries, Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga. Sri Aurobindo gets us back to that. Controlling the senses, Indriya Karmani. Controlling the breath, Prana Karmani. This is what we do. Even with the physical asana, this is what we do. So, the food eaten as the leavings of the sacrifice is, it is explained, the nectar of immortality, amrita, left over from the offering. And here we have still something of the old Vedic symbolism in which the soma wine was the physical symbol of the amrita, the immortalizing delight of the divine ecstasy won by the sacrifice, offered to the gods, and drunk by men. This is chapter 4, shloka 31. Yajna shisht amrita bhujya, eaters of the nectar. And thus we should eat and regard the work offered. So the divine, remember this is Krishna as Purushottama, Purushottama as Krishna, speaking to Arjuna and through Arjuna to the rest of humanity, saying that yes, what has been offered can then be taken. You give, and then you're not simply permitted to eat the nectar, you are encouraged, actively encouraged to eat once you have offered. Once it is no more yours, the divine says, here, enjoy. Huh. The offering itself is whatever working of his energy, physical or psychological, is consecrated by him in action of body or action of mind to the gods or God, to the self or to the universal powers, to one's own higher self or to the self in mankind and in all existences. And here we go back to chapter 3, shloka 17, if you want to make a note. This elaborate explanation of the yajna sets out with a vast and comprehensive definition in which it is declared that the act and energy and materials of the sacrifice, the giver and receiver of the sacrifice, the goal and object of the sacrifice, are all the one Brahman. Brahman is the giving. Brahman is the food offering. By Brahman, it is offered into the Brahman fire. Brahman is that which is to be attained by samadhi in Brahman action. Of course, this is the famous shloka 4:24. Brahmarpanam brahma havi brahma gnao brahmana hutam brahma ivatena gantavyam brahma karma samadhina. It's a wonderful, a revelatory declaration. This then is the knowledge in which the liberated man has to do works of sacrifice. It is the knowledge declared of old in the great Vedantic utterances. I am he. All this verily is the Brahman. Brahman is this self. So that's Chandogya Upanishad 4.11.1, Isha Upanishad 16, and Mandukya Upanishad 2. It is the knowledge of the entire unity. It is the one, manifest as the doer and the deed and the object of works, knower and knowledge and the object of knowledge. The universal energy into which the action is poured is the divine. The consecrated energy of the giving is the divine. Whatever is offered is only some form of the divine. The giver of the offering is the divine himself in man. The action, the work, the sacrifice is itself the divine in movement, in activity. The goal to be reached by sacrifice is the divine. For the man who has this knowledge and lives and acts in it, there can be no binding works, no personal and egoistically appropriated action. There is only the divine Purusha acting by the divine Prakriti in his own being, offering everything into the fire of his self-conscious cosmic energy. While the knowledge and the possession of his divine existence and consciousness by the soul unified with him is the goal of all this God-directed movement and activity. So the sentence above, for the man who has this knowledge, that's 441, and a little bit farther down, while the knowledge and the possession of his divine existence, etc., that's 433 and 35. To know that, and to live and act in this unifying consciousness, is to be free. That's 439. But all, even of the yogins, have not attained to this knowledge. Some yogins follow after the sacrifice, which is of the gods. Others offer the sacrifice by the sacrifice itself into the Brahman fire. 425. The former conceive of the divine in various forms and powers and seek him by various means, ordinances, dharmas, laws, or as we might say, settled rites of action, self-discipline, consecrated works. For the latter, those who already know, the simple fact of sacrifice, of offering whatever work to the divine itself, of casting all their activities into the unified divine consciousness and energy, is their one means, their one dharma. The means of sacrifice are various. The offerings are of many kinds. There is the psychological sacrifice of self-control and self-discipline, which leads to the higher self-possession and self-knowledge. And here, this coming up is 426 and 7. Some offer their senses into the fires of control. Others offer the objects of sense into the fires of sense. And others offer all the actions of the sense and all the actions of the vital force into the fire of the yoga of self-controlled, kindled by knowledge. There is, that is to say, the discipline which receives the objects of sense perception without allowing the mind to be disturbed or affected by its sense activities, the senses themselves becoming pure fires of sacrifice. There is the discipline which stills the senses so that the soul in its purity may appear from behind the veil of mind action, calm and still. There is the discipline by which, when the self is known, all the actions of the sense perceptions and all the action of the vital being are received into that one still and tranquil soul. So levels and levels of sacrifice. The offering of the striver after perfection may be material and physical, dravya yajna, 428, like that consecrated in worship by the devotee to his deity, or it may be the austerity of his self-discipline and energy of his soul directed to some high aim, tapo yajna, again, 428. Or it may be some form of yoga, like the pranayama of the Raja Yogins and Hatha Yogins, or any other yoga yajna, again, 428. All these tend to the purification of the being. All sacrifice is a way towards the attainment of the highest. The one thing needful, the saving principle, constant in all these variations, is to subordinate the lower activities, to diminish the control of desire and replace it by a superior energy, to abandon the purely egoistic enjoyment for that diviner delight which comes by sacrifice, by self-dedication, by self-mastery, by the giving up of one's lower impulses to a greater and higher aim. So one, through the action of sacrifice, the practice, the tapas, the increasing consecration, lifts oneself out of the small, common orbit of things and introduces you to more spacious realms of illumination. And slowly, slowly, you train your being to become greater and purer and wiser. So it's not something done for most all in the snap of a finger. That can happen. But most usually, there is this regulated advance. And sacrifice is the means by which we do it. They, and this is a quote from 431 again, they who enjoy the nectar of immortality left over from the sacrifice attain to the eternal Brahman. That's wonderful. So, having been able to give successfully the work, one enjoys the felicity, the fruit that comes from that, without claiming it, one enjoys it and attains identity with the Brahman. Huh. So, the great peace, the delight that the world offers, and no subjection to ego, no villainy from desire. Does that sound like a way forward in the path of works? Sacrifice is the law of the world, and nothing can be gained without it, neither mastery here, nor the possession of heavens beyond, nor the supreme possession of all. This world is not for him who doeth not sacrifice. How then any other world? Again, 431. Therefore, all these and many other forms of sacrifice have been extended in the mouth of the Brahman. Brahmana Mukhe. The mouth of that fire, which receives all offerings. They are all means and forms of the one great existence in activity, means by which the action of the human being can be offered up to that of which his outward existence is a part and with which his inmost self is one. That's 432. They are all born of work. That's 314 again. all proceed from and ordained by the one vast energy of the divine, which manifests itself in the universal karma and makes all the cosmic activity a progressive offering to the one self and Lord, and of which the last stage for the human being is self-knowledge and the possession of the divine or Brahmic consciousness. So knowing, thou shalt become free. 432. But there are gradations in the range of these various forms of sacrifice, the physical offering, the lowest, the sacrifice of knowledge, the highest. This is 433 through 435. Knowledge is that in which all this action culminates. Not any lower knowledge, but the highest, self-knowledge and God-knowledge, that which we can learn from those who know the true principles of existence, tattva darshinaha, that by possessing which we shall not fall again into the bewilderment of the mind's ignorance and into its bondage to mere sense knowledge and to the inferior activity of the desires and passions. The knowledge in which all culminates is that by which thou shalt see all existences, becomings, bhutani, without exception in the self, then in me. Chapter 4, Shloka 35. For the self is that one, immutable, all-pervading, all-containing, self-existent reality, or Brahman, hidden behind our mental being, into which our consciousness widens out when it is liberated from the ego. We come to see all beings as becomings, bhutani, within that one self-existence. Bhutani asheshana. But this self, or immutable Brahman, we see too to be the self-presentation to our essential psychological consciousness of a supreme being who is the source of our existence and of whom all that is mutable or immutable is the manifestation. He is God, the divine, the Purushottama. Again, chapter 13, shloka 22. To him we offer everything as a sacrifice. Into his hands we give up our actions. In his existence, we live and move. Unified with him in our nature and with all existence in him, we become one soul and one power of being with him and with all beings. With his supreme reality, we identify and unite our self-being. By works done for sacrifice, eliminating desire, we arrive at knowledge and at the soul's possession of itself. By works done in self-knowledge and God-knowledge, we are liberated into the unity, peace, and joy of the divine existence. So, shlokas 39 and 41 in chapter 4, and closing out shloka 23 in chapter 4. So, next time, the Lord of the Sacrifice. Let's close with some lines from Savitri. We talked earlier about the worlds. So this is In Book Two, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 11, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. And we'll start on page 271. In a sublimer and more daring soar, to the wide summit of the triple stairs, bare steps climbed up like flaming rocks of gold, burning their way to a pure absolute sky. August and few, the sovereign kings of thought, have made of space their wide, all-seeing gaze, surveying the enormous work of time. A breadth of all-containing consciousness, supported being in a still embrace. Intercessors with a luminous unseen, they capped in the long passage to the world the imperatives of the Creator's self, obeyed by unknowing earth, by conscious heaven. Their thoughts are partners in its vast control. A great all-ruling consciousness is there, and mind unwitting serves a higher power. It is a channel, not the source of all. The cosmos is no accident in time. There is a meaning in each play of chance. There is a freedom in each face of fate. O wisdom knows and guides the mysteried world. A truth gaze shapes its beings and events. A word self-born upon creation's heights, voice of the eternal in the temporal spheres, prophet of the seeings of the absolute, sows the idea's significance in form, and from that seed the growths of time arise. On peaks beyond our ken, the all-wisdom sits. A single and infallible look comes down, a silent touch from the supernal's air, awakes to ignorant knowledge in its acts, the secret power in the inconscient depths, compelling the blinded godhead to emerge, determining necessity's new dance as she passes through the circuit of the hours and vanishes from the chase of finite eyes down circling vistas of aeonic time. The unseizable forces of the cosmic whirl bear in their bacchant limbs the fixity of an original foresight that is fate. Even nature's ignorance is truth's instrument. Our struggling ego cannot change her course, yet is it a conscious power that moves in us? A seed idea is parent of our acts, and destiny the unrecognized child of will. Infallibly, by truth's directing gaze, all creatures here their secret self disclose, forced to become what in themselves they hide. For he who is, grows manifest in the years, and the slow Godhead shut within the cell climbs from the plasm to immortality. But hidden, but denied to mortal grasp, mystic, ineffable is the Spirit's truth, unspoken, caught only by the Spirit's eye. When naked of ego and mind, it hears the voice. It looks through light to ever greater light and sees eternity in sphering life. Namaste. Jai Ma.